You are listening to Ismail Hassan. I am the founder and head coach of Aikido of London. Welcome to the Aikido of London discussion series. And today's chat is with Yanti Amos from Norfolk and Beth Harris from Camden Town, London. And I've had both individuals here before, and they've kind of lovely and kind and decided to join us in again. So hi, ladies.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Glad to have you back on and to continue these series. And how's things in Norfolk, Yanti?
Great, really good. It's very interesting because things seem to have settled down a lot, and I'm in my own mind coming to terms with the situation, both the business and personal, and you know, the distance that we all have to cope with, community being obviously for me in New York. So things are settling into a nice August vibe for me. Thank you for asking.
That's okay. Nice to hear your voice again. And Beth, how are you? I saw you just when was it? Was it Wednesday?
Yes, it was Wednesday. Yeah,
because we're doing a training in the park now, where five or six people can gather, and that's the maximum that's still permitted. And although I look over my shoulder to other parts of the park, and there's a lot more than six people there, but we're having their picnics and whatever else. But we're behaving, and Beth joins in from a bit of Aikido weapons training. But hello, Beth, and how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm also doing well, kind of enjoying the lovely weather we've been having recently. It's been nice to get back and doing some weapons, though.
And you're waiting for Thursday, aren't you, I'm right?
Thursday is the big day.
And can you explain?
Yeah, exciting.
I get my A-level results on Thursday, a bit differently to how we would usually be getting them. But, yeah, it's exciting and a bit nervous, but... Hopefully it will turn out well, and I'll be going to university in the end of September. So
this year,
yes,
that's
wow.
You'll still be down the road, won't you?
Definitely.
Yeah. The Royal, what is it called? The Royal Veterinary
Royal College? Veterinary College. Yeah.
College. Yeah. Well, all the best and good luck for that.
Thank you.
Let's start, and I'm just thinking of what we discussed previously with some of the other podcasters, and we wanted to review a little bit more about women in training, and you know, Yanti and Beth, both ladies, but also renewal, which I think is a very challenging thing in life in general, and in training where we're immersed almost inescapably with repetition, where you're doing something over and over again, trying to understand it, but it becomes very familiar, and your members become very familiar, and what you're doing becomes very familiar, and then it can become possibly stale, or you think you know it, and things stop, and so the whole process of terminology that I've used before, Shoshin, coming from the Japanese Buddhist perspective, or authenticity is another way to look at it. And just thought, what you think of those, both coming from Yanti yourself, highly experienced, and in how many years now, Yanti, in karate?
Well, I started Taekwondo when I was probably Beth's age. So that's, probably over 35 years
and yoga as well, not as long, but quite a long time as well.
Not as long, but since 2003, I suppose, so coming on to almost two decades.
Wow.
There, so kind of crazy if I look back on it, because at the same time, now that I hear Beth's voice, I'm reminded of that youthful, wide-eyed attitude, perspective, mindset. I'm reminded of how I was when I was Beth's age, and it's wild, because it's just so I guess, evocative, because I feel like I can move from that mindset back and forth. I can kind of oscillate and shift and think how, when I speak, for example, to my students who are Beth's age in some cases, I learn a lot from casting my mind back, but also hearing how my current languaging may or may not land well on them, and how I can tweak it so that it becomes more more of an embodied practice for them. So it's so important for me to have that exchange with my students. So that's how I keep it alive and creative. That's sort of an entree into the idea of keeping the Zen beginner's mind, I guess, is what I'm saying.
And Beth, if you can just explain, how long now is it? Is it 2, is it 3 years yet?
3 years. I think coming up to 3 years now, yeah.
Cool.
Go ahead, Beth.
I was going to say, definitely have that beginner wide-eyed view, as Yanti was saying. I don't think I've... Even though it feels like I may have perfected or maybe more confident in a technique, I know that something will click later on, the way I move or kind of position myself, and that will then have an effect on a technique which I thought I had kind of moved on from. So I definitely still think I'll be in this wide-eyed beginner kind of mindset for a little while to come, but it's nice and it's refreshing and it's... I can, like you say, I've got people who are not speaking down to me as such, but are able to kind of communicate and make it so that I can understand kind of what they're trying to explain to me. So I think, yeah, it's definitely, I think I'm enjoying this beginner stage and learning more and becoming more aware of my own movement and how I feel comfortable, and then also trying to find out how I can push that a little bit more. So yeah, it's fun. It's a nice journey to be on, I think.
And I actually love that the current millennial generation are very expressive and very, you know, more opinionated perhaps than, and I'm generalizing, but when I was your age, Beth, I perhaps didn't articulate that I wasn't able to really put my finger on how I was embodying my movement in the martial arts and any other discipline for that matter. But I love how today you have this access to the internet, but you are a completely different generation and you're very much more expressive. And that's good for us as teachers and as people who want to communicate very complicated, very multi-layered, substantive knowledge base to you, and so the exchange, I think, is what's really important, and understanding as teachers how to articulate some of the principles and the fundamentals in a way that you'll understand it. And so I actually love the fact that I get tons of emails from my students telling me what they're going through, what they're embodying, and how they felt after class, how they feel before class, how they feel during the week. All of that's really important for us as teachers to be able to encourage you to love the martial arts as much as we love it.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's great. I think the communication's very key.
I agree, definitely.
Beth, do you find that it's still very novel for you, there's a novelty stage in anything we do where we're, as you say, you're fresh-eyed. But with that in mind, do you see the other members, for example, where there's quite an age disparity, and amongst them? I mean, I would say amongst them that it's quite a youthful dojo.
Definitely, yeah.
The spirit is young, and something I was chatting to Yanti a little earlier about is sometimes you get young people who've got a very old head on them. Yeah. outside an old spirit, which is not necessarily a bad thing. It could be even wiser ahead of the game in many ways. But in other times, some people seem tired, even though they're only 18 or 20 years old, 25 years old. You're quite grown up, is how I would describe you, but you're still 18. Are you 19 yet?
19 now, yeah.
When was that?
June.
Oh really? Well, happy birthday. Belated.
Happy birthday.
So, well, that which is fantastic. But that novelty, it's still a big part of where you're at, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I think just from kind of the feelings of talking about, Yancy, you were saying the emails you get from your students. When I go to the dojo, I still very much have that nervous energy, and I think I'm quite a mixture between very excited and all the adrenaline's going, like, oh, what's going to happen today? Will I be able to keep up? And that kind of energy is very kind of what I focus on when I go to the dojo. So it's quite nice when I get there, and all the seniors who have a lot more experience than me are very settled, and they have this innate confidence in themselves, which is something I'm still trying to get to. And I think for me, that's why I still have that very beginner mindset, because I'm still very nervous about myself and kind of what I'll be doing, rather than just being a bit more grounded. But I guess that will come with time and more experience and just gaining confidence. But yeah,
it's also because I am an introvert type, and so I had to work very hard, Beth, at just overcoming the sense of shyness and a tendency towards just being quiet and silent in a classroom context. But obviously, as a teacher, you have to be quite the opposite, and you have to really not just know your stuff and know how to explain it well, but deliver it, you know, have the right voice level and voice modulation, be able, especially in the martial arts, to be able to deliver the content and do the count, because in Shotokan, we count. And it has to be quite martial in the sense that you have to be able to project a really long distance, and you have to be able to reach the very last row. And of course, you're dealing with a mixed group with both men and women, and you need to be able to command that authority and gain the respect of everybody. So that was quite a journey for me.
Sounds very difficult.
And when you say, you know, you have that nervous energy when you come to the dojo and you're still absorbing everything, I think that sort of nervous energy is what I experienced as a new teacher. Mm. So one day, hopefully, you'll also become a teacher and be able to share your knowledge and your experience and your technical expertise in the same way that Ismail Sensei and I do. Obviously, Ismail at a much, much higher level, but you know, you'll get to the point where you get beyond your fears and your insecurities and your anxieties around being shy, perhaps. I don't know whether it's the same for you, I had to work really hard against that tendency to just want to be be happy being the most quiet person in the dojo as a recipient of knowledge and as a student. But then you make that transition into being someone who has to actually lead, and you've got, I don't know, 40 people in front of you waiting for you to count and to give a very beautiful sequenced class that makes sense and also imparts the right level of energy and the fundamentals and principles, so that everybody in the class, not just the raw beginners, but everyone at every little, you know, level, meaning intermediate, advanced, and then beyond, that they each get something out of the class that they can take away with them and work on. And so, you know, there's a little bit of self-imposed pressure that I do apply to myself when I teach, and so I can relate to the nervous energy because it doesn't really ever go away with me.
Going to say, Beth, that don't lose that. Actually, it's nervous energy. Whilst there's this, I suppose two opposites. On the one hand, you want to be calmer, more centered, which comes with time and experience and understanding. But the other part is that you got to part of that through that nervous use, but in implementation of that nervous energy. So there's sort of two forces at work here, and they kind of create you as you go along, and the danger is that if you ever lose that first part, the nervous one, the one that's where the heart gets going, there's an adrenaline. If you lose that, it becomes set, it becomes flat. And I think of in a previous podcast, there's urge last time we were talking about creativity in BVI. Mm. Before that, we were talking about fear in martial art, and fear in martial art is usually very associated. It's synonymous, but it's not unique. And I was thinking in particular acting. And when you think about, I was thinking in particular Ian McKellen when he gave a quote about, all these years, all these hundreds of thousands of performances globally of the highest caliber. And as soon as he walks there, as soon as he goes past the curtain, past the side where the audience can see him, his heart is beating, the adrenaline is there, and he confessed that the moment you lose that is probably the day you should bow out and say you've gave it a good run, and the time to call it a day has arrived. So it keeps it alive. It gives it the vitality that it needs, even though he probably doesn't even have to revise his review his words for some of his pieces, and I don't have to review what I'm teaching you quite often, although actually I do, because there's always something to dig in and extract out of it. There's always a slightly different perspective, even though essentially it's there at this stage of my life and my experience, it's there, but there's always another slant, another angle, and that keeps it fresh enough for myself as your teacher, but also as Yanti said, when someone new arrives, and it's a big deal for me, that because that nervous energy is good, and when the new kids have come along, which sadly not at the moment, but soon, they said we might be back in September, and fingers crossed we will be. But a lot of the teens, I think there's I don't know how to describe it. That nervous energy is like they don't like being nervous. Let me put it to you.
Yeah, but actually, I think you're right that it shouldn't be underestimated, because the nervous energy shows you care. And Laurence Olivier also said something similar to your quotation, Ismail, about always going to the stage with butterflies, and that he said was normal, and it was expected, and it was important, because if he lost the butterflies, it would mean that he didn't care about the level of performance that he was delivering or about to deliver, and that he didn't care about his the emotion behind the intention and the sincerity behind what he was offering up to his audience. And in your case, it would be to our students, because we care that they understand, we care that the outcome is that they'll be inspired and that they'll like it as much as we do. And so I think intentionality has a lot, and sincerity has a lot to do with that nervous energy.
So are you still nervous, Beth?
I'm not. A little bit, I think. Now I'm worried, I'm nervous that I've got the right nervous energy.
I think we're over.
I think yes and no, but I think yes, we can overanalyze. It is what it is, and simply put in and turn up, and you do the best with the tools you've been given, and that's as true for you as it is for me and for Yanti and for anybody else. In terms of maybe, I suppose, in a broader, I do ask people this, outside of Aikido and the Aido, which you do as well, do you find there is, it influences you? Do you bring that nervous energy elsewhere? Does it, do you feel the same sense, or does it change once you leave a class?
I actually find that after a class, I do feel a bit more grounded. Maybe it's from the fact that I've had to concentrate, or just the physical exercise has kind of made me a bit more tired, so I'm not as focused on what made me nervous in the first place. But often when I'm leaving class, I don't carry that nervous energy. I kind of leave it at the dojo, which is quite nice for me.
And is there anything else that you do where a similar energy is sort of rises up from you?
I think whenever I'm doing exams, or when I'm putting myself out there a little bit more, when I'm not kind of staying on the sidelines, I get that very similar nervous energy. That kind of fight or flight instinct is telling me if it doesn't go well, run.
It's the things I think Auntie's right. Then it's the things that you care about that bring that about. It made me go, Auntie. Go, sorry.
I just to extrapolate slightly on Beth's idea of the nervous energy and it being something where you put yourself out there, it could also be interpreted as being something that has deep meaning and something you care about. And it reminds me of, I don't know whether you guys have read the book Flow, and I don't know how to pronounce the author's last name, but his name's Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, whatever. It's really long. Forgive me for not pronouncing it correctly, but the book is Flow. And he talks about the psychological state of total engagement and deep meaning and intrinsic enjoyment in a challenging activity. And so if we consider, for example, Aikido or weapons work, or in my case, Shotokan, and in the yoga as being, you get lost in the actual flow of the experience of the movements, the physical movements, but also where your mind goes during the actual training, then there's something special that happens because it's not passive. It's not a relaxing or receptive type of state. It's actually intrinsically quite challenging. You have to apply yourself. And so I sort of feel like that is the flow state. That is where we're kind of stretched to a so-called limit in our body and mind. And we know it's not an easy to grasp thing, and yet we lose ourselves in it because we're enjoying it and we value it, if that makes sense. Does that
make sense? Firstly, it does. Secondly, a copy of the book was given to me by a previous student of mine who's no longer in England. And I never got around to reading it, so maybe that motivated me to read it. It sounds correct, but I was thinking it's interesting these qualities that are the sort of the fear, the nervous energy that that there are people who actually probably subconsciously repress it. So, because they don't like the feeling of being nervous, they don't like the feeling of, I suppose, not being in control, because that's how nervous energy often feels, like it's something that comes from within, but the feeling that it's something that's been created without, outside of you. So you come to a class and there's all these people more experienced than you, and they seem so powerful, and they look like they could just do whatever when you're a beginner, but of course it's still a controlled environment, but there's this situation. I think it's a societal thing that it dulls you because you don't like to feel that way, that maybe partly consciously you press it down, and so you create a numbing effect. So you walk in with the appearance of not being scared, but you're probably even more scared than you would be had you let that go. Because if you let it go and just let it express itself, it serves. It's there for a reason, and it'll actually serve you. It's a tool like anything else, and I think it's Maybe you know the nature of society, modern society, has created this thing there, where whenever a phenomena happens, and we're in the midst of a vast one with the COVID thing, that it's inescapable. That I mean, of course, I'm broadening this to beyond yoga, beyond karate or aikido, to just life itself. That. Having a little bit of nervous energy about you wherever you go, and I'm not talking about paranoia or being to that kind of extreme, but just having a little bit of it around is the thing that maybe as a youngster your mum and your dad instilled in you, so you don't get run over, so you don't So if you get carried away, you button up and you're too scared to do anything because the world is so dangerous. That's the extreme of it. But the other side of it is, especially when it's been cultivated and worked on, I'm not going to cross the road, it doesn't look right, I'm going to stay on this side. And that's bringing it to the influence of martial art, for example, within society. Your instincts are highlighted, and you learn to live with that little bit of uncertainty and make it your friend even, and it's sometimes it's not pretty, and that's okay as well, and we have to accept that as well, because the alternative is self denial, self repression, I think, and then how can you get and progress, and you're good at your karate, at your yoga, at your aikido, at your iaido, and anything else, unless you have a very technical, sort of intellectual approach to things, which is not the answer, not to the stuff that we do anyway. But I thought I'd throw that in, because flow, and I like to read this book now, sounds like what we're up to, that you unlock that and you give it recognition and you let it do its thing, and it's just a part of your life, and it'll last as long as you're hopefully as long as you're around.
Yeah, I think that you're right, that what we call the hypervigilant mode of the sympathetic nervous system is something that protects us. It's a positive thing, but it's dangerous if we are imbalanced and we're always in a hypervigilant mode. I think it's important to recognize that we need a balance of rest and digest, the parasympathetic with sympathetic, and bring it back to the nervous energy idea. I think we also have to respect that our martial art practice and training is dangerous. So it's physically dangerous. So we need to respect the fact that we can't be lax around our weapons and around each other if we're doing drills with an opponent, for example, or even just solo. And I think it's important to see the yin and the yang, if you like, of this approach, because there's a balance that we have to try to achieve with that nervous energy. We recognize when it's important. For example, we've just been doing some exams for some of our students. We've been doing it virtually, and we see how the performance of people under pressure is different because people are nervous. So we don't necessarily see the best of them, but we know, having seen them train every day for years and years, that perhaps in this moment they're not showing the best, but they really are, they're capable of so much more. But we understand that, you know, this person happens to be a really nervous type, and this person is just really cares so much that he or she is perhaps underperforming, if you like. But at the end of the day, what I think we see is that, you know, they are able to pull through in the best moments. Can come through during exam conditions or through a competition or through a tournament you watch. You see it a lot on YouTube, some of the fantastic tournament moments in any expert field happens in under pressure.
Yes,
in
yes.
In some of the big massive tournaments that we're all accustomed to watching in our respective fields. And again, if you come back to the flow book and the definition, it's, you know, the best moments occur when the person's body is stretched to its limits in a voluntary effort to really accomplish something difficult but it's so worthwhile, you know, whether that's training, whether it's a competition, whether it's a grading, whether it's something under pressure, or God forbid, in a real life context where we actually have to defend ourselves, we actually use our martial arts skills. So I don't know what I was, my point really was that, yeah, we're trying to really balance out the nervous energy and make it.
I see. I think your choice of terminology is better than mine. I think that's very good. I was thinking, Beth, that another side of it is when it's trained, adrenaline and nervous energy, a positive example of it is reflex. People have better reflexes. There's a sort of the mind body spirit thing can come into it, where you start doing things without realizing it. But of course, it's been trained, and it's this is something that I've always appreciated more. Part of Yanti's background and her husband, who's a very senior in the world of Shotokan karate, I always found, broadly speaking, that in Aikido, I don't know if they dull it, but they avoid the subject altogether. It becomes too predictable and too knowable. And so it becomes, I use it so often, and I hate that I do, but I'm afraid it's right. It becomes safe and comfortable, and it should never feel that way. It should not be terrifying. It should not be, unless you're geared that way, and that's a different discussion. In generally speaking, the striking arts, the immediately obvious striking arts do have that element in it, and I think that's a positive thing that they've got. I personally come from a background which is what I'm trying to show my members, including yourself, that it's a very dynamic school that I came from with Chiba-sensei, and I've never lost that sense of that. I've never seek to alter it. I don't think I can now. I think it's too deep in there. But that reflex is a remarkable thing. That if you can take it and turn it around that way, and again, I suppose you own it, make it your friend, and your mm-hmm. Aikido will change. It'll become even more alive, more rich, more dynamic. I was going to say flamboyant, but that's a personality thing. That's something different. But does that any of that make sense to you, Beth?
I think my reflexes have certainly become a bit more clearer because we've been doing weapons. I think sometimes it's been quite good, and I've kind of responded in the correct way in the right time. I do think that the fear that comes with doing weapons, because you've now got something which, if you kind of handle it wrong, will do some serious damage and actually hurt your fellow students. So I think you have to, that's when your reflexes and that nervous energy really needs to be controlled to make it safe for you and to make it safe for the other person. So I know definitely sometimes I've moved too quickly because I'm worried about a joke kind of coming towards my head, and that can then kind of affect how the other person moves as well. So I think that control of nervous energy has definitely been something I've been trying to work on more in weapons, and so it becomes more of a reflex rather than something that scares me. It becomes a bit more natural.
And can you see how that in time would also translate to your Aikido, where it doesn't seem as dangerous as it is with weapons, but that reflex should remain with that as well? Do you see that side of it?
Yes, no, I do, and I definitely, with the falls and making sure that your partner is safe as well as you are safe comes with kind of being able to control that nervous energy, so you're able to provide good ukemi or a good throw for your partner as well. So it's always, I think, it's not so much about you that's affected by the energy, it's the other person which then becomes affected as well. So I think it's quite important that you kind of learn to kind of control it and use it in a way that's beneficial to training.
Yeah, and I don't know about you, Beth, but do you, when you're learning something new, do you sort of come in from a micro view of yourself and then pan out and look at it from a macro perspective and see how other people are interacting with you, almost like you're a third person looking at yourself, I've sort of found that that can help in seeing how your energy is interpreted by other people.
I've never done that before.
Yeah, I started doing it when I did I got deep into my meditation practice, actually. And it really helps me with my martial arts because I was able not just to feel and embody techniques, but I then, challenged myself intellectually by imagining I was looking at myself and the way I was interacting with my partner at the time. And they can obviously vary from, you know, women of our own shape and size and weight, and then right up to the biggest guy in the dojo, you know. And so see how the way we move and the way we flow, in quotation marks, in and out of techniques, how it lands on your partner, but also how it might even be seen by someone like Ismail Sensei when he's watching you. So you can see yourself from different perspectives, and then you go right back in, you're able to see yourself from an embodied body, if you like. And so you can go in and out of that perspective and that way of looking at yourself and the whole training experience. And it sort of helped me to manage my anxieties around contact, you know, because with Shotokan, as it is with Aikido, I'm imagining you do have partners of very different sizes and weights, but you have to be able to know how to handle yourself in different contexts and different scenarios. So yeah, it's really it's been quite valuable, and that's something I sort of integrated the meditative aspect of my meditation practice into how I was moving in the dojo.
Well, it sounds like something very, very beneficial. I've often kind of wished that if when I'm doing something, if I pause, I can kind of almost step out of my body and kind of see kind of what position I'm in, and then tweak it and correct it, because it's sometimes quite difficult to see exactly what you're doing when you're doing it. So sometimes if we pause and either sensei or one of my seniors will say, oh, no, move your arm in a bit more or turn your hips more. For me, it's quite difficult to obviously imagine me doing that because I can't see myself. I can't see what I'm doing in the first place. So it's I think it definitely would be useful to kind of be able to get an outside perspective.
Yeah, and it can happen during class. It can happen during the so-called flow state, but it could also happen if you're just reflecting on it after or before class, or, you know, not even when you're expecting to train, but quietly at home, let's say you're studying. And because I'm the type of person, I don't know whether you're like this, but I like to read around the topic that I'm learning. And so it's as much an intellectual exercise as it is a physical embodiment exercise for me. So I do read a lot around the yoga, around the Shotokan. And, you know, I like to read about Aikido because I feel like the Aikido world has a lot of the philosophy understood, and I like to apply that to my Shotokan. But, I do it after hours, if you like, not necessarily if I'm expecting to train in an hour, or, you know, it's always in the quiet times when I can reflect and think deeply about what I do physically at other times of the day or week. So I feel like my learning as much, it happens as much on the mat as it does quietly, separately, as I'm daydreaming. Do you know, I'm daydreaming about it, or I'm washing the dishes, or I don't know, I'm packing the dishwasher or the washing machine, and I'm thinking, and maybe I'm looking at my dogi and I'm thinking, wow, it's really dirty or whatever, but I'm just sort of letting my mind drift. And I think those moments are kind of valuable in a weird, wonderful way, you know?
Yeah, you're far more intellectual than me. My reading is not as educational. I do actually occasionally, if I'm taking part in an event like Hyper Japan, or I was starting to study a little bit for an exam in Aikido, which was put on hold with coronavirus. Yeah. And I do have a couple of books which I did look at just to see how they described the movement, because sometimes that can be really helpful, just reading something and have it describe to you and trying to picture mm-hmm. it. And then I'll go and yeah. find a video of the technique online and I'll try to then copy it and see if yeah. I can take what I've read
yeah.
and kind of put that into practice. But I actually sometimes find myself, particularly if like at night before I go to sleep, mm-hmm. often after a training session,
yeah.
I'll suddenly jump out of bed and I'll try and recreate the footwork or yeah. try and just remember exactly yeah. what I did. So it's kind of fresh in my mind and it stays with yeah. me. I've kind of been doing that through lockdown. I'll suddenly like, how did Kaitanaga go? And I'll then try and do it on my own. I kind of understand that you're kind of always in that mindset. You're never quite disengaged from kind of dojo's training, home is relaxed.
Yeah.
You kind of have to try and bring both to each other, I think, to kind of make it well-rounded.
Yeah, I'm also possibly in that mindset because I'm thinking pretty regularly how I might deliver information and convey it. So I'm looking at sequencing and I'm looking at how to understand people's bodies and yeah. break some of the techniques down so that people can access those techniques easily. So maybe that's why maybe not overthinking, but I'm just prepping really. After hours, I'm prepping for the next class and thinking, oh, that person moved this way. Maybe he or she's having difficulties with their hips or, you know, and that's where I try to get creative. And, you know, coming back to the point about keeping things fresh is a mundane fundamental principle can become interesting because you're presented with a problem, how to make it interesting for someone who can't quite get it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So that becomes a fun exercise in and of itself. But
when you return to a class, the way you've just described it, when you do return to a class, does it help you? And how does it help you?
I think it just gives me a bit more confidence. Kind of, I've practiced the footwork. Even though that's a very, very small part of the movement, just knowing that I don't have to worry about what my feet are doing, I can then maybe focus on something else. I think, yeah, it just gives me a bit more confidence, a bit more calm, but that's only really for techniques that I kind of know very well. I don't like trying to attempt techniques which I'm not so familiar with in case I get into bad habits. In that case, I tend more to watch videos rather than try and do it myself, just so I can understand more in my mind.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Yourself, your own approach. You're saying you observe and you, I suppose it's fair to say, intellectualize some of it. But when you return to a class, especially a class, and I'm talking about karate to be specific here, when you're under pressure in a situation where thinking is on a elevated level, you have to be much quicker and on your toes with it. Has it assisted you? Has it given you a different, more depth, more reflex? Back to that again. How does it express itself?
That's a really good question. Because I've had various scenarios where I have fretted and I've worried that I'm not going to come up with a suitable response, especially if I'm teaching in a context where, you know, I've had this internationally where I'm teaching very advanced students, so above my own pay grade, if you know what I mean. So above, I'm actually a third dan, but I was gifted a fourth dan, and I sort of feel like I'm intellectually fourth dan, but I haven't actually embodied fourth dan. I do have the privilege and the honour of teaching very senior people when we do travel, and it puts you on the spot. It really does. It tests your own body of knowledge, but it also, I think I have learned over time that the nervous energy helps me realise that I'm giving to come to a point that we to come back to a point that you and I discussed, Isma, before the recording button got pressed. But it really is one person's perspective, and so you come down to your life experience and your life on the mat, and your, you know, how many decades of exposure in the martial arts world, and the exposure internationally really allows you to pick and choose the examples and the drills that you know will work because of this just intuitive understanding that this is what's appropriate right now in this moment for this group of people and for this particular question, if that makes sense. So you have to use that nervous energy, but you also use the depth of you have to mine in an instant what you think is relevant, pertinent, and will help people. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. The reason I asked, I was thinking, and something that's very a negative thing in the sense of anyone at any level, all of us that teaching, and this is a recollection of something Chiba Sensei said, which is very pertinent. Any kind of teaching methodology has ultimately a degree of a mechanical nature to it, and by that I take it that there's no such thing as a perfect system. And so, let's say you extract yourself and you try to see yourself in the third person, and you see yourself in the immediate engagement. The various ways of observing yourself and others, and all very useful tools. Going back to Beth's example, which is something I've encouraged before lockdown, and continue to do so, the self-study, and so just simple things like the footwork or the handwork or the feeling of a class, and try to recreate it, all very useful and essential. But the part that concerned me was that freshness again, that the two have got to come together, because that experience can actually become an enemy. That substantial knowledge and quote unquote correct knowledge can become stiff, and it can become set, even though somewhere down the line it was vital and it was beautifully expressed, that you don't move on, because that's what it was on September 5th, 1989, 2009. Mm. But we're older, we're more knowledgeable, we've moved on, life has changed, etc. That you flow and go with that, because that'll bring the authenticity, that this truth, if you want, that this is the same thing in principle, I'm teaching you the same thing, rather than, well, this is how we did it, this is how I was taught it, as I perceive it, and this is how I'll continue to teach it, which suggests getting stuck. It suggests getting set in one's ways, and even though it could be very, very high level, there's still a danger of getting set, which creates a stiffened mind, and the nimbleness and the liveliness has gone out of it. So it's just a thought on how we approach the teaching, as much as the learning side of things. That's pretty much it, really.
Yeah. No, great question.
it's quite in depth. Yeah, this is always interesting. But I think we've covered a lot as usual. And would you like to add anything else? Because I kind of run out of stuff at the moment, which is unusual. Beth,
I'm just kind of thinking about everything I've heard. It's like, wow. Teachers really have a lot to think about when they're planning a class, and when they have different people who learn in different ways. It's very, very impressive and very interesting to think about the different attitudes you need to different people.
I think, though, Beth, it really depends on what type of personality you are, because someone, for example, like my husband, who's been teaching for over four decades, maybe even longer, he's British national team, and so he's done a lot of competition experience in history, and also in Japan. And he goes into a classroom, for example, prior to a class, I'll say, so what are you going to teach? And he'll say, or a seminar, some kind of international event. And he said, not sure. And I'd say, what? Because I'm like I'm a preparer, you know, I'm a big note taker, and I love my moleskins. And he's not. I mean, he does take notes, obviously, and he's just written a book, and it's you know, a fabulous tale of his life journey and martial arts. But prior to a class, he lets the environment, the vibe, and the energy of who's in front of him dictate slightly the direction he goes. But I do believe that that's because he's had those decades of substantive knowledge and experience, and he wouldn't just go in there blind. He goes in there because he's done it thousands of, you know, thousands and thousands of times. And so he learns to read. He learns to read the room. And I'm sure, Ismail, you're like that to an extent. I think I've heard you say that each day is different, and the mood of not just the teacher but also the students is going to, you want to pick up on that, and you're going to see what is it that they need, what does the room need, as what does the group of people need, but also what do the individuals need. And I think it's a very advanced level of teaching if you're able to deliver something unique for each person, if that makes sense, because you can speak to all levels that, and everyone takes away from that class, and that's a sort of a unique
spot on actually. I think even to the extent, and it depends on the type of class you're running, where you leave your people alone, you show them something and then you let them run with it. You don't say anything, you don't interject, enjoy it, just watch it and see what they get up to. And and then sometimes that's okay as well. And sometimes they all bring a certain thing, and you gotta, okay, let's roll with them today. Let's do this. Other times, back to the moleskin, you can do that, but then you turn up and it's like everything that you planned is not doesn't unfold. It doesn't exactly happen, because it could be. And that one's a fascinating one. That. It could be that the students you're teaching aren't with the program. They just can't roll with it. It's not that they're without a program at all. They're not with that particular program. But sometimes, even when you're prepared, and I've done my fair share of that as well, many years back now, but you can prepare. And by the time you get to class, you're not in that skin. You're not in that structure either. So it's alive. True. So it's but it's a very big learning curve. I think that's ahead of you, Beth. You know, if I wear my teacher's hat here, but.
More stuff to look forward to.
And don't lose, you know, as your teacher, and if I put that hat on again, don't lose that nervous energy. It's really new. People get, I mean, in all walks of life, we get tired of things, and that's natural. It's how you come back and how you renew and how you refresh that, and it's just coming back to who you are, really, and you find that out, and then all these great actors have said, don't lose your butterflies. It's a wonderful thing. Not only does it mean you care, but it means it's a very good indicator that you're alive. And there's nothing like it. It's a rush, and it should always be a rush. I'd like to say thank you very much for both of you for joining in. I think it's this is a slightly different format than before, having a inexperience and experience and from a different background. But
Beth's going to teach me.
Yeah, she's been commanded. you should pop over whenever you can, Yanti, for priorities that we pop over first. You know, that I said, I think that our venue will be available in September, and fingers crossed things don't change and that does happen, but it looks like it's on the way, and as soon as you get a moment and if you've got a time, just come over. You're more than welcome. And thank you very much for joining us. Always a pleasure to have you. And Beth, see you in the park.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Ismail.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye. Bye. You have been listening to the Icon of London Discussion Series.